This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economic Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net. Hello, my name's Mark Hayes, and it's my pleasure as Secretary of PKSG to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. On the 14th of January 2009, our guest speaker was Professor Roy Rothheim of Skidmore College in the US, speaking on the theme Keynes, Davidson and the General Theory. You can download a PowerPoint presentation to go with the talk from the Keynes Seminar page on the PKSG website. Enjoy listening.
Thank you. Am I talking about Keynes, Paul Davidson and the General Theory, or Paul Davidson, Keynes and the General Theory?
Well, that I leave entirely up to you.
No, that's important. David Lodge, in one of his books, Small World, spoke about one of the characters, Percy McGarrigle, who had just got his PhD at Trinity College Dublin, who wrote his dissertation on the influence of T.S. Eliot on William Shakespeare. So it's important. The order. It's the order.
I don't believe that.
Order is important. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for inviting me. And again, I got to know Mark, actually, because he invited me to be on a panel to discuss his book. And I must say it's one of the most interesting discussions of Keynes. So many people write about Keynes and about Keynes and about Keynes. And, well, the book is quirky in how it is presented, it is thoughtful on every page, and I learned a great deal. Anyway, just quickly, yes, I was a student of Paul Davidson's, and I should probably take a minute and tell you how that came about. After I decided I didn't want to be a surgeon anymore, I found economics and studied econometrics and labor economics as an undergraduate, and my supervisor then sent me on to Rutgers, because that's where he went, to work with certain people there who did labor economics, etc. And so I did. And I went to sign up for classes the first day, and on the little sheet I had put in I put down economic development. And this person with whom I was supposed to study took out his pen and crossed it out. He said, "Oh, no, you can't take that course that's taught by an institutionalist." Now, I had no idea what an institutionalist was, but and so I signed up for his course in human capital theory until I bought the books. And, of course, all the books were by Gary Becker. And so I'm afraid I went to him and I said, "Look, I can't take this course because I've read all the books already and, frankly, don't like them." And so that was that. Shortly after that, I lost all of my stipend. Then the other professor with whom I was supposed to speak, I came into his seminar, and right before he came in, we were laughing about Arnold Harberger's work on deadweight loss. And I was the one who happened to have been speaking at the moment, and he looked at me and he said, "Well, Mr. Rothheim, I guess you don't believe in downward sloping demand curves either." So that was the end of that experience. I was standing in the hallway about a month later, and those two chaps were speaking, and one said to the other, "I just got a letter from Davidson." Well, I didn't know who Davidson was. Turns out he's an institutionalist. And I said, "Aha, that's the guy I'm going to study with." And I did. So I began studying with Paul, actually, when he came back from Cambridge. He had written a draft of Money in the Real World, and we got mimeograph copies. I don't know if you know what a mimeograph is, but, it's something that you go like that with, and it gets these blue copies, and the book was this thick. And we proceeded to go through it with him. And then went on to write my PhD with him after that. So I want to talk tonight a little bit about this industry called Keynes and a few firms in that industry, and one in particular, Paul Davidson. I can't cover everything because he writes a lot, and I'll try to give you some of the essential aspects of what's on his mind, where he was coming, etc. If you look at this industry, the Keynes industry, it usually presents three products to the consuming public. What did Keynes say? What's the title of your book?
The Economics of Keynes.
A new guide to the general theory. That is, what did he mean by what he said? And what, if anything, are we equipped to do policy-wise in light of what he said? Well, Mark, in his book, tells the reader that Keynes meant to say exactly what he did say. So if Mark's correct, there's nothing for me to talk about. And
just read the general theory.
Just read the book or read Mark's book. Still, okay, let's talk a little bit. The dominant firm right now is called New Keynesian Economics, which obviously doesn't have a clue as to what Keynes either said or meant, even though one of their members, Paul Krugman, was asked to write an introduction to the latest volume of Keynes, and in fact, Jeff's written a most interesting review of that. But the names, you know, roll off. Larry Summers, Ben Bernanke, Janet Yellen, all important people right now in the U.S. administration. Alan Blinder and others. It's doing very well. But, of course, I've been asked to speak about another product on the market, the product offered by Paul Davidson. And so we're going to talk about Paul Davidson Keynes and the general theory. I think it's fair to say that Paul is not the dominant firm in this industry, nor probably is anybody else in this room. Which means that Paul must have gotten it wrong, which is why there are no buyers of his product. Although I have another theory, which is that there may have not been buyers because he wasn't a member of the inner circle. And he was from Penn and then Rutgers, actually first from Brooklyn College. He didn't go to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, MIT, he wasn't on the faculty, perhaps even Chicago, Stanford, or Cal Berkeley. And so therefore, why would anybody read Paul Davidson any more than they would read Sidney Weintraub? And I think that had a lot to do with it. And just because he wrote a lot doesn't mean that people were going to read it. It's kind of like the anti-Field of Dreams. I don't know if you're familiar with the movie Field of Dreams, but basically it said, if you build it, they will come. Well, if you write it, they're not going to read it. And I'm afraid that's what's happened to Paul Davidson. And so if he's not the dominant firm, and nobody knows much about what he's written, although they probably all know his name, why would we want to substitute a Davidsonian typewriter for what we now have as our new Keynesian voice recognition system? Well, even though there is only one product, it doesn't hurt to at least be in a crowd with other people who fight windmills, and therefore let's go ahead and talk a little bit about Paul. Well, what did Keynes say? Let's start there, and you can look behind me. I'm not going to make it up. Okay? And in fact, I'm not even going to read it to you, since it's right there. That's what Keynes said. What do you mean by any of this? I once was at a conference sitting next to George Shackle, and some people were discussing a topic and wondering, what would George Shackle have felt about this? And I leaned over to him and said, why doesn't somebody ask you? And he said, I don't know. Well, that's what Keynes said. But of course, the devil is in the details. And so what's happened since he wrote this? Well, we know right away, as soon as this came out, is there a way of how does one, or are people going to have to stare at this for the rest of the time until I move on? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, as soon as the book was published, obviously, the devil, in fact, to find the details, because we find Hicks and Harrod immediately responding, both with Mr. Keynes and the classics, as well as Mr. Keynes and traditional theory. Keynes reads both of those papers, which of course have laid the foundation for how generations have understood Keynes in terms of the ISLM framework. He writes to Hicks, I really have nothing, postcard in fact, I have nothing much to say about this, I pretty much agree with it. Oh, by the way, you tend to make investment a function of current income, I tend to make it a function of expected income, and that seems to be the big difference between what I'm doing and what you're doing. Hicks, of course, responds by saying, no, I don't care, I want to do it my way anyhow. In fact, he very arrogantly responds, saying, no, I think it's better to do it this way, which obviously means that what you just read and how Hicks interpreted what you just read are not the same thing. Harrod, Keynes writes a very long letter praising him up and down. This is the most wonderful thing I've read. You've done such a brilliant job. I'm having to give a speech, I believe, in Stockholm. I wish I could just read it myself. Oh, by the way, you left out my theory of effective demand. Well, from there, of course, not surprisingly, fitting it into the little static box that they did, we move on to what was called the neoclassical synthesis provided by Modigliani in the 40s, and then Modigliani's interpretation winds its way into Paul Samuelson's textbook, Economics, and then suddenly we have these short-run variations that can occur, which can cause mischief, even though we kind of sense that in the long run, we're back in the world of classicism and everything is fine. And that's what we saw in debates in the journals, the textbooks, and the halls of governments, having to do with, well, in the short period, is monetary policy more significant or is fiscal policy more significant? And that's what we saw the debates in the 60s, knowing fully well, but in the long run, those debates really don't matter, but it's good for the short run. We saw the same thing in the history of Britain in terms of their reliance, at least in the policy area, on Keynes at other times and not relying on him at yet other times. Nothing doing, however, for the evil empire where Taylor rules the roost, being the Bundesbank in ECB drag, where they haven't paid attention to any of that, regardless. And so what I've said, basically, is that Keynes' economics has morphed into new Keynesian economics, which assumes that somehow markets can get clogged, wages and prices can be sticky, all because of informational asymmetries in the labor market and the capital market, as if one of those or both of those ever existed. And therefore, Keynesian policies could be used to mitigate as mitigating devices so long as they don't jump over the time barrier into the long run. And of course, we know that John Robinson deemed this hijacking of Keynes to be pre-Keynesian economics after Keynes and the other one, which we all know. Sidney Weintraub called it classical Keynesianism. Well, as we know now, and I won't go into it, all ideology is off the table as the world is collapsing. And suddenly, in fact, in the Wall Street Journal just the other day, there was a lead article saying the new, old, big thing in economics, JMK. Well, okay. Keynes did talk about all of that stuff in terms of his policy prescriptions, but by causing him to revert to a short-run static framework, there's no theoretical foundation at all from which these policies emanated. In fact, these policies were very important in the 1920s in Britain, long before Keynes ever wrote the general theory. So, in fact, having public works policies and doing anything and everything to save the financial institution is nice, and of course, Keynes felt very strongly about it, but it had nothing to do with the general theory. Where, in fact, we want to think about a theory of value, which, as Keynes wanted to do, bring the theory of price back into the theory of value, where he wanted to be skeptical of a mere monetary policy to bring down the rate of interest to encourage long-term growth. And the most interesting part is, as he said, the state might be in a better position to calculate the marginal efficiencies of capital goods on long-term views, and on the basis of the general social advantage, taking an ever greater responsibility for directing organized investment. And if ever that were true, we're going to be seeing it right now, I think. I think there's going to be a significant structural change in the way economies function, at least I hope. Just as an interesting footnote, that idea he got from Pigou, who in 1913, Wealth and Welfare, but who's counting? Okay. You'd be amazed at the amount of ideas that we find in Keynes that, in fact, were in Pigou. But, of course, Pigou wrote so much that, you know, everything had to be in Pigou. But these ideas in particular, Pigou thought very carefully about. Anyway, there were other interpretations of Keynes, one which I'm not going to spend time on, but it's a very interesting topic, which some people call epistemological or Chapter 12 Keynesianism, which basically said that, oh, he got Chapter 11 all wrong, the inducement to invest, it's a static framework, and why are you shaking your head?
We were talking about this at dinner.
Yeah, and therefore, if you really want to get to some interesting stuff, let's look at Chapter 12, where he really opens the system and starts talking about uncertainty and about the need for conventional behavior and speculation and enterprise. I disagree strongly with that view, but that's a separate topic, which says here, skip to page 9. I will, however, quote one authority on the topic who wrote, Keynes himself was never comfortable with the analysis and the presentation of his theory of investment in Chapter 11 of the General Theory, the marginal efficiency of capital. He much preferred the freedom from formal constraints to be found in his exposition of the exhilarating Chapter 12. He contains some of his finest and most memorable passages, for example, on the nature and operation of the stock exchange and the consequences for the behavior of the economy when enterprise and speculation change places. Does that sound familiar?
Sounds.
You wrote it. Okay. But we won't go there. Because, in fact, I think, and actually Tony and I have had this conversation many times, then, in fact, I think one needs to think about Chapters 11 and 12 in terms of Chapter 11 setting what one might say is the underlying generative mechanism by which we think about the problems. And then, in fact, by virtue of the fact that the demand price for capital is not equal to the marginal productivity of capital. In fact, Keynes rejects the idea of marginal productivity of capital. He said, I can't think of any measurement of capital that would be independent of values. We wonder where he got that idea. So therefore, it's marginal product. I have no idea what it means. But more importantly, the marginal product of capital is something that is internal to the particular capital good. The prospective yield, however, has to do with the fact not only that the firm will produce a product based upon that capital good, but that other firms will be engaging capital also to produce products, and that everybody, both buying the capital goods and producing goods, are going to create outcomes which are going to change the circumstances by which that yield accrues to the firm. That's the meaning of uncertainty. It's not that we just can't know it because it's too far out in the future. It's because our actions cause the results which change the circumstances by which we know things and by which we can conduct our behaviors. Okay? So that, in fact, setting up the idea of a prospective yield in those terms then allows you to ask all of the interesting questions in Chapter 12 about the state of long-term expectation, as he makes sure he always reminds us. But we won't go into that. Then there were, of course, Keynes's disciples, and what Jeff has called the Cambridge post-Keynesians, or Pasanetti has called the Cambridge Keynesians. And I find that especially interesting because they were so involved in the book as it was being written, but once the book came out, they let Keynes hang out to dry. really didn't do much to defend the book. He was out there all by himself. And one wonders why. One wonders why they took off in a completely different direction in the sense of trying to understand questions about capital accumulation and trying to use some of the signposts that Keynes set for them, but also relying heavily on Kolesky and on Ricardo. Some people have said Marx. Paul Davidson always says that, oh, there was a strong Marxist influence, but I know better than that. Marx had nothing to do with that. Certainly not the good Marx, just the bad Marx. I'm not going to spend too much time on that either, although it is very important in one respect. And the thing that makes it important is that, unlike the static Keynesians, unlike the subjectivist Keynesians, the Cambridge Keynesians tried to do what I think Keynes was trying to do also, which was to try to understand the idea that the theory of price and the theory of value emanate within the process of the creation of products themselves. And by virtue of the fact that there are durable goods involved, that means that that sets the tone for thinking in terms of time. And therefore, the logical direction that one would take from studying Keynes is to think actually in terms of an economic dynamics. So that in that sense, I think it is fair to call them post-Keynesians or Cambridge Keynesians, even though, and I'm not going to do this here, I would suggest that they fell into the type of mechanistic traps that, at the end of the day, move them away from Keynes's idea of a monetary economy. In fact, it's very interesting if you go back to Marshall's defense of his own principles in a really interesting article that most people don't know about. An Exchange in Production in Economic Journal in 1898, he's talking about how economics has become more and more interested in dynamics, but the problem is that the dynamics is a mechanical dynamics and mechanics more akin to physics. He said because, frankly, economies don't work that way, that dynamics are actually evolutionary, they're biological. And a biological dynamics is one which tries to understand the internal circumstances that actually generate the changes themselves. And I would contend that the Cambridge Keynesians, unfortunately, have not moved in that direction. But that's another topic as well. Okay, well, that brings me to Paul Davidson. Because, you see, Paul doesn't fit into any of those categories. Paul is Paul. And rather than relying on the earlier statics, as so many of the Keynesians did, rather than relying on a subjectivism, which, in his opinion, took them far afield from where Keynes was trying to ground his theories, and trying not to rely on Ricardo and Kolesky, because again, he felt that the type of dynamics that emanated from that was in fact timeless, did not include money, and therefore could not possibly be linked to what Keynes called the monetary economy, and therefore that left him with all by himself, trying to go back and look at Keynes himself and to say, what can I learn from Keynes given the fact that I think that there is an incipient dynamic framework that emerges from Keynes that perhaps comes from, I would say, a more biological than, in fact, mechanical fashion. And that's how I've always seen Paul Davidson trying to grope with these issues. Has he succeeded? Sometimes. Sometimes he hasn't. Sometimes he guess, to be a little too much of a Keynesian literalist. Again, I know this is going to be recorded and Paul will probably be hearing it, but nonetheless, and he probably doesn't remember this, but he would come into our seminar and basically by heart quote from the general theory. And so we decided that the next time he did that, we would all stand up and put our hands on our heart. And in fact, he did not too long into the class, and we all stood up and we went like this, and I think he got the point. But I guess...
What a pack of bastards
you were. We really... Well, we were worse than that. But you figure if lots of populations can memorize the Quran, Paul can at least memorize the general theory. Anyway, okay, so... Let's try to figure out what was on Paul's mind. And here I'm just gonna you know, basically deviate from my text a little bit because it's kind of turgid and this is an informal audience. Let me tell you a little bit about Paul Davidson that you may not know. Paul did not study to be an economist. Paul went to Brooklyn College, in Brooklyn, where all my family went, except my father, who. Crossed the river and went to Columbia, and that's always been an interesting thing in my family, but I think that's kind of salient in Paul's case as well, because in fact he didn't go to Columbia, he went to Brooklyn College. Why? Well, there must be lots of reasons, but one is Brooklyn College was free, and he studied biology and chemistry. In fact, he then went on to the University of Pennsylvania, and he went so far as to write his dissertation in biochemistry, and he was teaching in the medical school, and then he chucked it. Went back to the City University of New York, studied economics and statistics, wrote his master's thesis for his MBA in statistics, went back to Philadelphia to study with Sidney Weintraub in economics to get his PhD. Sidney Weintraub, does that name ring a bell?
Yes, of course.
Well, I'm looking at the younger people here.
No,
yeah. At this point in my classes, I used to see this Quasimodo ring a bell, but we won't go there. But yeah, Sidney Weintraub. Now, see, this is what's so interesting about all of this. Rather obscure figure in Keynesian economics, and yet he was Paul Davidson's mentor, and Paul said, I learned more from reading Sidney about Keynes than I did from reading Keynes. Now, how did Sidney learn Keynes? Well, Sidney went to NYU, New York University, which Paul tells me, according to Sidney, was a bastion of conservatism and mainstream economics. He then graduated and got his doctorate and went on to LSE for a while, which was still under the specter of Hayek. But he picked up a copy of Keynes's General Theory at a bookseller somewhere and picked it up and learned it all on his own. Came back to the States and wrote a book called An Introduction to the Theory of Income Distribution. I highly recommend it. 1958. I know it was written more than 10 years ago, but nonetheless, it's something that one should read. And again, Davidson said that I understand Keynes from that book more than from Keynes. If you don't read that book, you don't really understand Keynes. It's pretty interesting. Okay? And in fact, Davidson wrote his doctoral dissertation under Sid Weintraub on theories of aggregate income distribution. And in the next, this was 1960, 1959, 1960, and in the next 7 years, published many articles, including some rather famous ones, including the Finance Motive. He also wrote a book with Gene Smolensky on aggregate demand and supply analysis. Well, if you go back to Weintraub's Introduction to Theory of Income Distribution, you find all of that in the book. Both aggregate demand and aggregate supply framework and the Finance Motive. It's all there. It's a phenomenal book. It's really interesting. But then something happened. In 1965, James Tobin has a piece published in Econometrica called Money and Economic Growth. And there, Tobin said, all traditional growth models are non-monetary. They're all based on the idea that savings will also always equal investment, that, as he called it, the warranted rate of growth of the capital stock will always equal the natural rate of the growth of the labor force. And therefore, through the real interest rate mechanism, savings will always create its own investment, and everything will be fine. The problem is, it says, with the Cambridge Keynesians, although he didn't call them those, but including Roy Harrod, Nicholas Kaldor, and John Robinson, they try to separate the investment from the savings decision. And in fact, try to think about the fact that investment creates its own savings. It's not savings that necessarily creates its own investment. And that, in fact, if one makes a savings decision, it's going to be based on different factors than if a firm makes an investment decision. And it is possible under certain circumstances that firms may only accept a minimum rate of return on capital below which they will not invest, whereas savers don't have that problem. And therefore, it's possible for the warranted rate of growth to deviate from the natural rate of growth of the labor force, and there's no mechanism that brings them back together. And so Tobin asks the question, wait a minute. If people are going to save, but they're not going to invest, where's that money going to, where's that savings going to go to? He said the whole analysis cries out for some other asset. And that asset has to be money. So he brings in money. I wasn't going to talk about this actually, but it's a nice story. He brings in money, and the most interesting money. He says money is something that comes from the central government. The central government sets the price on money. People now can choose to save by buying capital goods or by, in effect, buying money. Now, something that Paul doesn't address, but I kind of scratch my head and ask, what are they giving the government to get this money in return? I mean, if you have some type of a commodity that I guess can either be consumed or invested, then does that mean that you are giving cups of coffee to the government in return getting money? I mean, there can't be any other thing. Well, that, of course, is not something that Tobin addresses. Suddenly, there's this money. It comes from outside. And now it's possible for, in fact, to have a situation where there is some price called the money rate of interest, which can set the floor below which no investment will occur. So how do they deal with the inequality? How do they deal with what he calls Harrod's dilemma? Well, that's simple. They just keep running greater and greater and greater deficits. And as they keep running greater and greater deficits, they're going to provide more and more money, and that will make up the difference. But of course, more and more money must imply that prices are going to go up. And if prices are going to go up, then the real value of those commodities is going to fall, and equilibrium will be restored nonetheless. So either equilibrium will be restored by the government providing more money, or the higher money will cause prices to be higher and bring the system back. Well, Paul Davidson reads this, and within a couple of months, he writes a piece saying, this is crazy. This is crazy because if you're going to suddenly bring in money into what is a non-monetary system, but this money doesn't come from banks, this money has nothing to do with the production process, this money is just something that falls from the sky, and in fact it's directly related to the price level, then in fact really you are imposing the classical dichotomy, which means that even Tobin's model is a full employment model, and it's no better than any of the other models he is criticizing. In fact, there's really no need for money at all. Now, Paul tells me that he wrote this article as soon as Tobin's article came out, but that in fact Econometrica held it for 2.5 years because they were waiting for Tobin to reply, which he never did. Well, Paul's reply eventually does come out, and he writes that piece in Econometrica, and then he has another piece come out in the Economic Journal a year later. And between those two pieces, he basically sets the foundation for what becomes, in 1972, Money in the Real World, which is what I cut my teeth on, and in fact, I think, is as close as anyone has come to trying to think about an incipient economic dynamics from the way Keynes would have thought about the problem. So let me talk a little bit about that, okay. Because I think it's kind of interesting. I know Paul used to always say that the general theory is a classic being a book that everyone's heard about and nobody's read. I think for post-Keynesians, probably the same is true for Money in the Real World. And how many people in this room have read Money in the Real World?
I've suddenly looked at it at some stage.
That's what I figured. Okay. It's a classic. So, what does Paul try to do in that book? What he tries to do is that he tries to think about what was Keynes' idea of what Keynes called a monetary economy. It is, why would we ever have money? Davidson already showed that even Tobin's attempt to include money into a growing economy was invalid unless money had certain essential properties and somehow was linked with the production process. So what he tries to do in this book is he tries to understand the meaning of a monetary economy, somehow recognizing that at the heart of it all is both the production process and the capital accumulation process. That in fact, as both Jeff in his recent book and Passanetti in his recent book point out, is that in a way, their idea of the Cambridge Keynesians, I would say the same for Paul, we're trying to go back to what the classical political economists were looking for, which is not trying to understand the allocation of scarce resources to satisfy unlimited wants, but what are the circumstances by which scarcity is overcome. And that's what he tries to do in this book, but trying to come as close to Keynes as he possibly can. The link, of course, is the fact that in a production process you need durable equipment. Keynes says it is by reason of the existence of durable equipment that the economic future is linked to the present. It's therefore consonant with and agreeable to our broad principles of thought that the expectation of the future should affect the present through the demand price for durable equipment. But then at another point, Keynes says it's also money that links the future to the present. Well, that shouldn't be surprising, because in fact, both money is nothing more in Keynes's mind than another asset. And in fact, he said, even if legal tender were abolished, some durable good would assert itself if it had the correct properties as the money asset. And in fact, this is what Paul wanted to do. He wanted to say, look, let's try to understand what Keynes called the monetary economy in terms of this incipient growth process and to actually look at what the firm is doing. One of the things that always impressed Paul, and you can find pretty clearly in the general theory, is that Keynes reckoned that capitalist systems do fluctuate and can get pretty bad. But they tend to fluctuate in some realm of stability. That they do not fluctuate wildly. And this, of course, is a response to the critics who said that the general theory was written as an attempt to mitigate the evils of the Great Depression. No. Keynes was trying to understand a theoretical framework and was trying to understand, wait a minute, how come it is not only that capitalist economies fluctuate, but also that they fluctuate within a range of stability? What's going on here? What are things that anchor the system? And that's the context in which he wanted to understand, at least what I learned from Paul, that's the way he wanted to understand how monetary economy functioned. And the way one did that was in terms of looking at assets, asset prices, the creation of assets, and alike. Think about it this way. And this comes from Marx, not from Davidson. We talked a lot. We spent a lot of time together. We never talked about Marx. But Marx basically says, at one point in Capital, he says, you know, capitalism is all about starting out with money and winding up with more money than when you started. And production is one of those unfortunate intermediaries that come in between them, but if somebody could help it, they wouldn't get involved in it. And that's the question. Why do we produce? Why don't we just try to do what the mercantilists did, which basically turn over goods and try to make more money than when we started? And that was the question that Paul wanted to address, even though he would not have attributed to Marx. Somebody starts with money, and in from back they're a producer. They go out onto a market to get means of production, not members of parliament, and labor. And then they take that and they mix it up and produce the letter P. Can I do this? That's cool. All right. And then they generate a commodity. So basically it's, excuse the expression, I think this is kind of a catchy phrase, the production of commodities by means of commodities. Now, I'm not going to argue about whether the value of this is greater than the value of this. Marx, of course, thought it was. In manufacturing, the physiocrats thought it wasn't. But at this point, that's not salient. It will be later on, because, in fact, Keynes did say, I do believe in a labor theory of value. I think it makes a lot of sense. Certainly, it's the only thing that I can understand that creates value, because capital certainly doesn't, because I don't know how to measure it. Nonetheless, this commodity then has to be sold at some price in a market. So now we have the creation of products, the production process itself, and input markets and output markets. The process of production, two processes of circulation. And I think it's very interesting to think in these terms. Because as a producer, whether it's in the short run, short period, or in the long period, you don't know whether you're going to sell your goods. You don't know the prices at which those goods are going to sell. You don't know, I'll get there. You don't know, in a sense, if these markets are constantly fluctuating and if you have to hire people every day. You don't know what your wages are going to be tomorrow. You don't know what it's going to cost you to rent certain things, to hire certain capital goods, etc. There are lots of things you don't know. You can only expect things to happen. Now, in the short period and in the long period, there's a greater likelihood that a firm will either take its own money or borrow money and go out and rent means of production or purchase them in input markets and then take them and produce output and then sell them at some price, the greater the amount of anchors that can exist at every level. Because the more each of these relationships is anchored, the greater the confidence that a producer will have when she embarks on making this hiring and production decision. If everything fluctuates, if the price of inputs fluctuate, if each day you produced for market, and if each day you had to go out and go to the hiring hall and hire a new set of workers and rent new machinery, and if every day you took your goods to some outdoor market and the price you sold it at was just determined by the number of people who queued up, it would be very unlikely that you would engage in this process. And so what Keynes wanted to understand is, both in the short period and in the long period, given the fact that we cannot know for sure what any of these things might be, are there circumstances in a monetary economy that in fact anchor them? Anchor them to the point, not fix them, but at least anchor them, tether. Maybe a better word is tether them. So that there's a greater likelihood that our expectation will be calmed and therefore we will commit to this process. And so what Davidson tried to do following Keynes is to see what are those factors that caused these pegs, these anchors, these tethers to occur in a monetary economy, because without them, you're going to find that your economy is going to be highly unstable. But the economy is not highly unstable, according to Keynes. So the only way that's possible is there have to be some tethers. There have to be some things that just are relatively stable, for whatever that might be. And that, even though Davidson would never admit to looking to this, I think this is a wonderful device for understanding his understanding of the general theory. So, what does he do? Well, he begins his book, therefore, by talking about production and pricing. Oh, after he has a basic introduction where he talks about all the different schools of economics from the left all the way to the right. I guess for me, you, that would be from the left all the way to the right. And, sorry, I'm a teacher. I can do that. And, of course, then there is the middle called Keynes. And what did you say before? We're cruel. One of the cruel things we always did was that we would always write that out and put Davidson's name right in the middle and nobody else's. Then he has a chapter on, a very interesting chapter, by the way. You actually, since you've never read the book, what did they say, The Life of Brian? If you never see another movie, you'll never see this one. If you never read this book, then you'll never see the second chapter. But if you do see the book and if you do read the chapter, it's a very interesting chapter because he talks all about risk versus uncertainty. And he is influenced profoundly by the writings of Shackle, who talks about the difference between cerebral experiments and crucial experiments, where a crucial experiment is one where conducting the experiment changes the circumstances under which the experiment can be re-performed. And where this is all leading, well, both for Shackle and for Davidson, was that unlike the consumption of coffee, if I've never had coffee before, I can spend the pound, get myself a cup of coffee, and if I don't like it, I never have to buy coffee again. But if I buy a capital good, we've got problems. Because I cannot necessarily sell it right away, and therefore that's going to change the circumstances under which I can re-perform any experiment. So that became a very important part of Davidson's way of thinking, because for him, that helped him understand the notion of uncertainty that he think underlay Keynes's idea about uncertainty. Now, then in the next chapter, what does he talk about? Well, prices and production. And what he wants to do is that he wants to talk about two aspects of this process. One, how are firms going to produce? How are they going to set their prices? He said, firms generally don't simply produce goods and go out and sell their goods for whatever price they can get. And whatever happens, they'll go back and change their production flow the next day. No, that's too much uncertainty for a firm. That generally what firms do is that they set some standard volume of output, and here the influence of Kaldor is very important. They set some standard volume of output. They look at their costs. They then choose a particular flow of output. They mark up over that flow of output. And then they proceed to produce that output, put it onto the market at the price which is going to give them a normal profit, and then see what happens. If there's an increase in demand, the queue is lengthened. If there's a fall in demand, inventories build up. But it's very important, Davidson says, that one doesn't get too excited about short-run changes in demand, because instead we have to understand the longer period, because it's a longer period that's going to give us our tether. Now, why is it that we're going to have a tether? Well, he said, because if you look at your cost function, costs tend to be constant over a significant period of output. Why do costs tend to be constant over a significant period of output? Because the prime cost of production are labor costs. And in fact, in a world of uncertainty, the rational worker will only bargain for a relative money wage over an extended period of time. They want to lock it in. And I won't go into the reasons why that's true. But it will be irrational to bargain in real wages, because you can't affect your real wage. Because again, in a world of uncertainty, it's all workers and their actions and the effect that they have on costs and the effect that costs have on prices which is going to determine the real wage. Well, how can they possibly predict that in advance? They need a tether as well. I was a Boy Scout. They need a tether as well. And so for workers in an uncertain world, the tether for them is bargaining in relative money wages over a contractual period. And therefore, to the extent that money wages are the prime cost of production, one would expect that the cost curve, the average cost curve, over a reasonable period of time would be constant, and therefore one could mark up above that with a normal rate of return, and that's what would be the price. Okay, well, we're starting to think about a number of factors here. Some tethers. Some things that at least producers start to rely on. We see that here, at least, this relationship here, there's a tether to the extent that workers bargain in relative money wages over a period of time, that they tend to be sticky in a downward direction. And therefore, producers will know over reasonable, at least the life of the labor contract, what money wage is going to be. That's a tether. To the extent that they set their prices in terms of some markup, whether it's full course pricing or any of the types of pricing that we've written about, Jeff actually has a nice piece on that with Peter Kenyon. Again, it's another tether. The more tethers we have, the more likely that producers will actually commit resources. Well, now I have 1 minute left. let's move into the accumulation process where the distance is farther out. And Keynes used the word more uncertain, didn't he? That's like saying more pregnant, okay? But in fact, where we're now talking about durable assets that extend over a longer period of time. And again, how do we think about that? And so rather than looking at chapter 11, the infamous chapter 11 of the general theory, no, Keynes jumps, what's his face? Paul jumps all the way to chapter 17, where he said, look, if Keynes said that in a monetary economy, even if they got rid of legal tender, some durable asset would serve the functions of money if they had the correct properties, then look at the demand and supply of durable assets. Now, we already have the supply side. Because on the supply side, generally, you have a horizontal average cost curve until you reach or come close to capacity when your supply curve starts to rise because of diminishing returns. And of course, Keynes's notion of diminishing returns were not the same as the traditional notion of diminishing returns. In fact, Claudio Sardoni has written a very nice article on that in History of Political Economy a long time ago on what Keynes meant by actually moving to older and older vintages of capital and therefore the cost per unit of output rising. It's not that if you added more and more labor to a given vintage of output, any more than if he spoke at the same time I did, this would be a better or a worse lecture with the same PowerPoint presentation, okay? Or if I had two PowerPoint presentations and one person talking, that would somehow improve my marginal productivity. No, that's not what Keynes was interested in, okay? Take that notion, which Davidson lays out right in the beginning. Move on to capital accumulation, but think about it in terms of the demand for an asset. And now he says, let's look at assets. They have three components. They have a yield, if they're producible. They have a carrying cost by hanging on to them, and they have a liquidity premium, the ability to go out there and sell them. Well, the first thing we know about durable assets, capital goods, is that they're not very good if you try to go out and sell them. They're just as heat. This he borrows from Kaldor, and as I pointed out to him, Kaldor borrowed from Marshall, which is that capital goods don't have well-organized and continuous spot markets. And therefore, if you buy that thing as a store of value, don't be surprised that when you try to sell it next week, you're not going to make a lot of money on it. Okay, so that in fact, the liquidity premium of a capital asset is not something we look at. It is something that you purchase to make other stuff. Then what Davidson does very interestingly is that he takes the idea of the demand price for capital from chapter 11, but the supply price of capital goods in the supply of capital producing industry, just like any product production, which we already learned about earlier, taking on the same form. There's a quantity of goods at any moment in time, but really what's preponderant in that equation is our ability to produce more goods. And of course, to make any sense of that, you have to go back to chapter one of Ricardo's principles. And so what Paul says was, let's take the demand price for capital goods, which obviously are a function of the prospective yield on capital assets, where there's uncertainty. But let's do the best we can in terms of somehow coming up with a marginal efficiency of capital. We can argue whether there's a marginal efficiency of capital or marginal efficiency of investment some other time. And then what he does is that he sets up a stock flow analysis, interestingly enough, where he says, in the current period, if the demand for capital is high enough, so high that the price that would get a producer to be able to purchase a capital good, which is produced now, is greater than what it costs to reproduce that capital good, the supply price of capital, then it'll be in the interest of producers to produce more capital goods. A situation which Harrod calls normal backwardation. Actually, Keynes called it also. So as the demand for capital goods rises, its spot price rises above the flow supply price, causing producers of capital goods to produce more and causing capital goods flow supply prices eventually to rise as well. Well, I'm going to move away from that story. Give me one more second. I'm going to move away from that story for a second, although, again, it's very important to understand that to the extent that producers weigh the marginal efficiency of a capital asset relative to the rate of interest, another tether has to be the knowledge that the rate of interest is, money rate of interest is not going to be significantly different today than it is tomorrow, which must have something to do with the value of that loan between now and the future, which have something to do with the price of products that that money can buy, which we've already found out, according to Keynes, was reasonably tethered, because we're not interested in fluctuating prices of things that they exist now, but the ability to reproduce them, which over a significant period of time are going to be relatively stable. Why? Because money wages, which are the prime cost of production, are going to be relatively stable. See how this all fits together? But what about money? And then I'll finish. What about money? Money can't buy your love, and it can't produce goods and services itself. It is not produced. It may have carrying costs, but it does have a liquidity premium. There are well-organized and continuous spot markets for money that don't exist for capital goods. Or as Yogi Berra would say, it's money is the equivalent of cash, which is why it's so good. Now, Keynes believed, and here's where this gets a little mechanical, but Davidson tries to follow this as best he can, that as an economy expands, Keynes says the marginal efficiency of capital assets begins to fall. And now, of course, we run into a problem of time, because is the marginal efficiency of capital the prospective yield of a capital asset, or is it the actual yield of a capital asset? And that's a very important question. And I think it's an inconsistency that we all recognize in Keynes. He does tend to move back and forth between expectation and reality. And what Keynes said was, one after another, the marginal efficiencies, or what he called the own rates of interest on each of those capital assets, is going to fall and eventually go below zero. In other words, they're not going to make any money. And so that money is going to be the only asset that has a positive yield, because he says this liquidity premium exceeds its carrying cost, which is something that doesn't happen for any other capital asset. And so therefore what everybody does is that they fly into money. Well, if they flew into capital goods, what would happen? The spot price of capital would be greater than the flow supply price of capital, and more capital goods would be produced. Such is not the case with money. Because you see, money has what Keynes called a negligible elasticity of productivity. Means you can increase the demand all you want, but the price is going to go up, but you can't get any more of it. Now, this does not mean that a central bank cannot produce more. It's not the same thing, and a lot of people have confused that. The point is that the increased demand for money, which is going to cause the price of money to rise because there is no flow supply price of money, means that the increased demand for money is not going to divert employment from the capital goods industry to the money producing industry. That's the rub. But secondly, he said there's a zero or negligible elasticity of substitutability between money and all other capital assets, because money is the only asset whose liquidity premium exceeds its carrying cost. Nobody in their right mind would ever jump to capital assets, no matter what happens to the price of money. And suddenly you run into a situation where unemployment occurs, and there's no market mechanism that's going to get you out of that. There's no fluctuation in any relative price that's going to get you out of that. Somehow, there has to be a change in the state of long-term expectation. Somehow, there has to be a central bank which is going to provide the extra money. And somehow, banks are going to have to be willing to lend out that money. Sound familiar? And somehow, somebody's going to be willing to borrow that money in order not to engage in speculative actions, but to, in fact, engage in productive actions. Will that happen? When will it happen? For how long will it be until it happens? Well, we do know that it does happen, according to Keynes and according to Davidson. But the question is, for how long? And in the meantime, can any worker lower her wage in order to get a job? No. Which must mean that unemployment is voluntary. And in fact, as Keynes told us, if all workers tried to lower their wages, it could very well be that it would make the situation worse, not better. So an economy can actually stick at a level of employment below full employment, which brings us right back to what did Keynes say. There's so much more in Money in the Real World, but that's the story. And I think Davidson goes about it in the most interesting, most creative way. Sure, the devil is in the details in that book as well. And there are lots of issues and problems with the book, just as there is with any book. But the way he goes about that problem, I think, tries to approach an economic dynamics as a biological process, trying to understand it from within the process of production itself, within a world of uncertainty. Which perhaps post-Keynesians should just go back and read one more time, particularly as we're starting to see the direction of post-Keynesian economics moving more and more away from that, away from the biological notion, away from the Keynesian notion of economics, and back toward more of a mechanical physics type of growth process, which, if Davidson is correct, is a non-monetary economy, and therefore gives us no insights into unemployment, because it couldn't exist unless there were full employment.